Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true?
They don't think Christianity's true.
They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
You know, friends, just recently I was reading an ancient document, and it started this way. See if this sounds familiar to you. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Adrian, Iturea and Trachonitis, and Licinius, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John, son of Zechariah, in the desert. Now, for those of you astute readers of the New Testament, will realize that is Luke chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. It starts out in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, and then mentions a number of governing officials right after that. Doesn't really sound like this Luke, who wrote this down, is making up a story, does it? It sounds like he has some familiarity with the governing of the area in which he's writing, or of which he's writing. And it turns out that appears to be exactly the case. Now, for those of you that have the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, you know in chapter 10 that Dr. Norman Geiser and I listed well over 140 eyewitness details that are in the New Testament. Most of them that we listed come from the book of Acts and also from the Gospel of John. And some of these details are, like I just mentioned, Pontius Pilate. These are people that were known at the time, and they were known through other historical writings and even archaeology. For those of you that have listened to this program before, you know, one of the best guests we've ever had on, and we're having some great guests. We had Dr. Ed Faeser last week. Today, we're going to have Dr. Tim McGrew on, and for those of you that know about Dr. Tim McGrew, he's been on the program, I think, three times before. We had him on over Easter talking about the evidence for Jesus being alive. We've had him on twice before that to talk about undesigned coincidences in the New Testament. These are things that the average reader doesn't see unless you know something about history, unless you know something about the first century. And Dr. McGrew, being an expert in these areas, is going to enlighten us on some of the amazing evidence that you find sitting right there in the text, just waiting to be recognized by you if you have the historical background. And let me ask you this before I get to Dr. McGrew. How many of you out there who homeschool your children have them read Josephus? Well, our guest today, Dr. Tim McGrew, has his daughter read Josephus in homeschool and write reports on it. You go, who's Josephus? Well, we'll talk about it today. So my guest is Dr. Tim McGrew. He's a professor at Western Michigan University, and it's a great pleasure to have him on. Tim, thanks for being on the show again.
Thanks so much, Frank. It's great to be back.
Hey, Tim, this passage here in Luke chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, the one I read at the top of the show. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that, would you?
Oh, it's a wonderful passage because he's nailing down so many different things there. He's talking about the beginning of John the Baptist's ministry. That's the time he's trying to start with. And we know that Jesus' ministry came right on the heels of John's ministry. John had a public ministry stretched over maybe less than a year, and then he was imprisoned by Herod Antipas. But here's the really interesting thing about that. Actually, there's so many, I don't know which to start with first. But start with in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, as the Jews count years, that would mean 14 plus something. So in the 15th year, like we would say that a newborn child is in his first year. So when did Tiberius begin to reign? Well, you can date that from two times. You can date it from the time when Caesar Augustus died. That would be the year 14. Or you can date it from the year he began to have a kind of co-regency with Augustus. That's the year 12, 2 years earlier. Most people think it's probably the 2 years earlier. So what that does is you take 12 and you add 14 and a bit to it, and you're somewhere into the year 26, okay, mm-hmm. AD 26. And about a year later than that, Jesus begins his public ministry. Well, what's the first scene of Jesus? Jesus' public ministry. Remember the first miracle that he works? It's in Cana of Galilee.
Oh, sure, yeah, the wedding. Yeah.
Right, Luke doesn't talk about this, but John does. And right after that, he goes to Jerusalem, and he cleans out the temple for the first time, where they're like making a little bit of profit out of selling sacrificial animals to poor people. And Jesus is very unhappy with that, and some of the people whose tables he's overturning are not happy with him. And they say, well, by what authority do you do this? And he says, destroy this temple and I'll raise it up in 3 days. That's probably as much of it as most of us remember.
Right.
But there's a funny finishing line. In John 2, verse 20, the Jews say to him, this temple's been in the building 46 years, and you say you're going to build it up in 3 days? So there's this strange detail. It's been 46 years in the building. Well, what does that mean? Turns out that in the year 18 or 19, Herod the Great, 18 or 19 BC, Herod the Great began building the temple. The right. outer works were finished in a year and a half. The courts were finished off in another 8 years, but there was all kinds of other building stuff going on with it that was still ongoing in Jesus' lifetime. So if we check out the year 18 BC, and then we go, using the Jewish method of reckoning, 46 means 45 plus some. Can we move 45 years forward? We find that we're in the year 27, which is 1 year after the year 26, which is the year that is the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius, reckoning it from his first ascent to co-regency with Augustus. So these two verses, which have nothing else in common, both nail down with a chronological specificity that's really quite remarkable, exactly the right time periods for the spacing of John's ministry and the beginning of Jesus' ministry.
You know, I've often heard that this was 29 A.D., but you're saying it's 26 A.D. because of the co-regency?
I think that that's a plausible way to nail it down. There's basically two broadly plausible ways of doing it. You can say Jesus died in the year 30, or he died in the year 33. And you can make a case for either one. A lot of it depends on how you're going to count the beginning of the reign of Tiberius and whether you're going to use the Jewish way of counting a year or whether you're going to wait until the year's complete to count it. So between those two things and these two verses, you can get one or the other. I'm inclined to go with the earlier dating, but if somebody wants to say 33 instead of 30, it's not worth fighting about. Either way, the two verses come out right in the same zone, and this way they actually come out exactly right.
You know, one of the things I say when I do the I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist presentation on campus is that when we get to the eyewitness testimony, one of the E's I present is eyewitness testimony, I always say that the New Testament writers put historical crosshairs in the text. And it seems to me that this passage in Luke contains several historical crosshairs, naming all those government officials as one. And then, of course, the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar. He's certainly not making all this up. But, Tim, you go into a lot more detail even than that in analyzing this, because you're well-versed in Josephus. Tell our listeners briefly who Josephus was and why he's an authority on this period in Palestine.
Sure. Josephus was a Jewish historian who was born in the 30s A.D., so born just, you know, within the decade after the crucifixion of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And he was an active participant in the Great Jewish War when the Romans surrounded and besieged and ultimately sacked and destroyed Jerusalem in the year 66 to 70 A.D. He was on the Jewish side. He was a Pharisee. He was a priest of the high priestly caste from the first course of the priests. He's got quite an interesting biography that he's written up. But he got captured by the Romans, and he actually switched sides and became a translator for the Romans. When he was imprisoned by the Romans, he prophesied that the Romans would not only the Romans would win success, but also that the Flavian dynasty would come to power in Rome itself. And when Vespasian became emperor, that was taken as a sign that Josephus had been onto something. And so they not only released him, but they honored him and they paid his dues for writing a long history. And so that history then enables us to get a Jewish view of the first century, and that's what makes Josephus such an excellent person to talk to.
We're talking to Dr. Tim McGrew. You're not going to believe the tapestry of Scripture when we come back from the break, because there's evidence in there that you don't see unless you know history. Dr. Tim McGrew will tell us about it right after the break. Don't go away. back listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. The website is crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. We present evidence for Christianity. We cross-examine ideas against it. We go to a lot of college campuses, high schools, and churches. We're also on TV, DirecTV, Channel 378, which is on Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Time. It is also on Saturday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. That's DirecTV, Channel 378. And look, if you don't have DirecTV, no big deal. Go to crossexamined.org and watch it streaming live on our new website. So you can see it there. We're right now doing Why I Still Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist on TV. So you can check that out. My guest today, Dr. Tim McGrew, all the way from Western Michigan University. He's been on the show several times before. He's a wealth of great information, bringing forth evidence that the general public, even most apologists, don't know about, because he's a student of history and he can see how the interaction between the scriptures and the current or the context at the time, in this particular case, the history of Palestine, how they go together so well. It's a woven tapestry. And Tim, you talk about the fact that the New Testament documents understand the complex political history of Palestine, the groups in Palestine at the time, including the Jews, the Samaritans, the Romans. They portray the Roman authorities correctly. They portray the Jewish authorities correctly. And they also portray particular events correctly. So let's spend a little bit of time going through this. You mentioned Josephus. You were about to finish your thought on Josephus. What did he write for us, and why is it considered authoritative information on the first century Palestine?
Well, simply because he's a first-century author. So he lived through some of the events he recounts, and he lives pretty close up to some of the other events he recounts. He gives us a connected history of the Jews called the Antiquities of the Jews, referred to as just Josephus' Antiquities. And in that, he tells the history of the Jews from a Jewish point of view, going all the way back to the beginning and then moving forward into the period covered by the New Testament. So when you get to Josephus books, 15 to 20 of the Antiquities, you're in the zone for the kinds of things that come up and get mentioned in the New Testament, particularly books 16, 17, and 18 are really, really key. And that's why I had my daughter read them, because you find out a lot of things that the New Testament authors don't even say, but they show awareness of them by something they mention in passing, and you get the fuller picture when you read Josephus.
By the way, friends, you can read Josephus online. It's up online. If you Google it, you'll find it. You'll find those chapters Dr. McGrew's talking about. I highly encourage you to do that. Give us some examples. Let's start with the most skeptical view out there, Tim, and that is, the gospel writers were just first century novel writers. It's mostly fiction. And I know you don't buy that. Why not?
Well, how do you go about assessing a claim like that? You look at the actual stuff they wrote. And you try to say, does this read like people who are just using some broad things like, the Roman Empire exists, there's a city called Jerusalem, as a framework for the story they tell? Or do they show awareness of the details of the history that shows that they're right up next to the facts? The more of that you get, the less plausible the they're writing a novel kind of perspective becomes. And it turns out that if you start looking, you find this all over the place. I'm going to just give you some idea of how this works. So the New Testament starts with the birth of Jesus, and it runs through the founding of the church. And so we see that, and then Acts takes us, out to the point where Paul's at Rome. Let's just take that period between, say, the year 6 B.C., maybe the year that Jesus was born, and about A.D. 44. Turns out that's an important date. Here you got 50 years, and that 50-year period is incredibly complex. It begins the whole area of Palestine as one united kingdom under Herod the Great. We find this out in Josephus. We can read all about it in Josephus. Matthew just mentions, right, Matthew 2, verse 1, that it was in the reign of Herod the Great that Jesus was born, the wise men came. But then he dies, and it's all divided up into these little tetrarchies and ethnarchies, and that's alluded to briefly both in Luke 3, 1 and 2, which you just read, and in Matthew 2, 22. But then the guy who's in control in Judea, which is now just one part of that, gets sacked for mismanagement, and instead of putting somebody else in as a new tetrarch or ethnarch, they send a Roman governor. So part of this area is still ruled by these little petty kings, and one part of it is ruled by a Roman governor. And then it's all reunited into a single kingdom again under Herod Agrippa I, who is mentioned in Luke 12:1. He's mentioned in Luke 12:1 as a king, which he was, exercising power in Judea, which no one for the previous 30 years had done. And never was there a king in Judea again after his death, but for 3 years at the end of his life, he was king. And then the whole area is reduced to the level of a Roman province.
Now, what year,
all of this
what,
by the year 44. So it's just it's going through all these changes, and it's really, really hard for somebody who didn't live through it to follow all the ins and outs of this. But the New Testament writers, they walk through this without ever setting a foot wrong.
So Herod the Great dies in what year?
Four BC? 4 BC.
Okay, so one of his sons, Archelaus, takes over, mm-hmm. and then is sacked in about 6 AD, correct?
Right. He takes over in Judea, but not in the other provinces. This is why Mary and Joseph and the infant Jesus can go up into Galilee, and it's not under Archelaus' control. It's under Herod Antipas, his younger brother.
Right, and he does that because, as you said on this program before, Archelaus slaughtered about 3,000 people in the temple during Passover.
Within like a couple of weeks of taking control in Judea, that's right. It was not an auspicious beginning.
Okay, so then a number of years later, 10 or so years later, according to Josephus, he's sacked, he's exiled to France, current-day France, mm-hmm. and you're saying then who governs it from 6 AD to when does the next Herod take over as king for 3 years?
He gets in the year 41.
41.
So
okay,
the period of Jesus' life, Judea is under the control of procurators. It's Valerius Gratus and his successors, culminating in Pontius Pilate in the New Testament period. And then after Pontius Pilate, you find Felix in the Book of Acts, uh-huh. and then Porcius Festus takes over again in the Book of Acts. So you see these guys coming and going, and it's interesting because we know something about them from other sources as well. But what makes all of this so hard for a forger to try to make anything of is that because Palestine was never conquered, they invited the Romans in. A large portion of the populace said, oh, please come and make us part of your empire. The whole period is not only complex in terms of who's in charge where, it's also complex in terms of the actual political situation. So, for example, there's a double system of taxation. There's a Jewish tax. You find this in Matthew chapter 17, verse 24. Does your master, these guys come and ask Peter, does your master pay the temple tax? That's a Jewish tax. But there's also Roman taxation, right? Matthew 22, is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar? Separate tax. So there's two systems of taxation. There's two systems of marking the years. The passage in Luke you read, notice that he gives a Jewish way and a Roman way, right? Roman way, mm-hmm. 15th year of the emperor. Jewish
right.
way, when these two guys were high priests.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, right. I didn't notice that. Right there in that passage.
Right there in that very verse.
Both. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a double military command in John 18:3. It's a group of the Jewish temple guard, the Levitical guard, who come out to grab Jesus by night. But at the cross, how many piles did that divide Jesus' stuff up into? Four piles. It's a Roman quaternion. So there's a double military command, subordination of them, right? The Jewish are subordinate to the Romans, but they do have some of their own soldiers. There's a double administration of justice. Jesus gets tried twice, once in Caiaphas' house and once by Pilate. There's two modes of capital punishment. The Jews stone people to death. They don't technically have the legal right to do that without Roman go-ahead, but that's their go-to method, and when they get out of hand, that's what they do to Stephen. The Romans crucify you. There are two major languages. There's the Aramaic, which is the common Jewish language, and there's Greek, which is the lingua franca of the Roman Empire. And in the little statement on the cross, you see it up in three languages, right? It's up there in Latin and Greek and the Hebrew dialect, the Aramaic. So all of these little changes and differences and doublings of things make this an incredible minefield for anyone who's writing a novel. If you're going to write a novel, you want to stay away from this place and time. But if you live through it and you know who was in charge when, then you'll just casually say, Herod the king stretched out his hand to trouble the church and he put James to death. And you'll know that there was a Herod, one of the many Herods, and that he was a king at that time, even though there had never been a king in Jerusalem for the previous 30 years.
So the way the New Testament writers write these details, they don't write them in a way that's trying to convince you that they're telling the truth in the sense that they're explaining anything. They just kind of mention this stuff in passing, don't they?
Exactly, and that's what makes it so important. If they were writing a history of Palestine, then we'd expect them to name lots and lots of details. Josephus does that for us, but they're telling you the story of Jesus or the story of the founding of the church in the book of Acts. And it's only incidentally that these little things come up. And for just that reason, they're much more valuable because they obviously don't represent lots and lots of research on Google trying to get it right. These guys just knew what happened, and they're telling it the way they know it went down.
We're talking to Dr. Tim McGrew. So, Tim, you've just pointed out that the period in Palestine that the New Testament, the context of the New Testament is written from, had, let me just review, double systems of taxation. It had a shift in the manner of dividing the night watches, which is
pointed out. That's a nice one. That shows up that the Jewish divided the night into three watches, so there's a middle watch.
Uh-huh.
And that comes up, if you want to look that up, you can actually go back to like Judges 7, I believe, and Judges 7:19. But the Roman division's got four watches. Yeah.
You got double military command, double administration of justice. You said Jesus was tried twice. You had two modes of capital punishment, stoning and crucifixion. You had three principal languages used. Well, two mostly in the area, but then you had the Latin on the cross. And all this is in the New Testament, sort of without comment. Mm-hmm. It's just assumed.
Yeah.
And nobody would know this unless they were there.
That is pretty much the point.
Hmm.
So these guys get it right over and over again. And at a certain point, you say, okay, you got it right so many times. At what point do we say it's just not fair to say, well, they only got right the things we can check up. Probably they got all the other stuff wrong.
Right.
Come on.
Right. Well, we're going to go into a lot more depth after this next break. So we haven't gone into enough depth already. We're talking to Dr. Timothy McGrew. He teaches at Western Michigan University, one of the few bright lights out there in our secular universities. And he's an expert, as you can see, on history, particular history in first century Palestine. So we're going to talk about how the New Testament talks about or depicts the Jews, the Romans, the Samaritans. We'll look at other details in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And we're going to see this tapestry known as the Bible has so much evidence behind it if you just know a little bit of history. It's quite affirming. I'm Frank Turek. Back in just 2 minutes. Don't touch that dial. We're talking to Dr. Timothy McGrew. My name is Frank Turek. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. So if you're down low on the FM dial looking for NPR, go no further. We're actually going to tell you the truth here. And we've got an expert in first century history, particularly history in the Holy Land in the first century. And oh, by the way, we're going to the Holy Land next month. Me and Bob Cornuk, the real Indiana Jones, are leading a group into the Holy Land at the end of May. And then we're going on our footsteps of Paul Cruz, just like we did last year. This is going to be an amazing trip. If you're interested at all in seeing where Jesus stood and where the apostles stood and particularly where Paul went, you need to come on this trip with us. Go to crossexamined.org, crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. You can click on the ship that you'll see when you get onto the website, or you can go to livingpassages.com. Either one of those places will get you the information, crossexamined.org. It's going to be a great, great trip. I hope you can join us. Now, we're talking to Dr. Timothy McGrew from Western Michigan University, not Eastern Michigan. Tim, before I ask you another question about the first century Palestinian situation, how it relates to the New Testament, if people want to learn more about this off your website, where do they go?
You know, we've got a lot of resources up at historicalapologetics.org, just all run together, historicalapologetics.org. And there's a browse the library button on the left-hand side. Click that, go through. There's tons of information there. All of it is free. None of it is under copyright, so you don't have to worry that you're pirating anything. It's all free stuff. And this is one of the best ways to educate yourself. Get some of these great old books and just start reading. Get a copy of Josephus. As you said, Frank, it's available online. You can just read it on your own computer. But start looking into this and connecting the dots.
Historicalapologetics.org.
Yep.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some of the groups that we see in the New Testament.
Sure.
For example, in John 4, there's obviously a group of people known as the Samaritans. Can you tell us about them and what the historical significance and how it relates to the New
passage.
Testament?
The Samaritans were half-breed Jews who had intermarried during the captivity. And then they had returned, but they weren't on real friendly terms with the Jews down around Jerusalem. That's actually putting it mildly. If you read John 4, Jesus asks this Samaritan woman for a drink. And she says to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me? I'm a Samaritan woman." And then there's this little parenthetical remark, "For Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." Now, here's the funny thing. That's an understatement, and we know this from that Jewish historian, Josephus, in his Antiquities, Book 18, Chapter 2. He tells a story of an event that happened just after Jesus was probably taken to the temple at the age of 12, right? So we get that bit that he goes to the temple, and then there's that whole story, "Don't you know that I must be about my father's business," because they lose him in Jerusalem and have to turn back looking for him. But just after that, there was a Passover feast. And here's how much the Samaritans hated the Jews. They didn't want to worship in the temple. They had their own temple. And they came down to the temple at Passover in disguise, looking like they were Jewish pilgrims for the Jewish feast. And then they when the doors of the temple opened at midnight and all the crowds came in, because there was an enormous number of sacrifices to be made, so they started right at the stroke of midnight, they walked through the temple and they strewed body parts, like parts of dead bodies, all around the temple, making the whole thing ritually unclean. That's a pretty nasty act. They had also been known to slaughter some pilgrims. They killed some Galileans who were on their way down to do their sacrifices at the temple for Passover. They during the intertestamental period, before the opening of the New Testament, they would steal Jewish land and in some cases enslave the Jews. So there was just a lot of enmity between them. So that comes out there, but that's the least of it. There's so many other nice touches in this. Look just for one example at John 4:22.
4:22.
Yeah, Jesus is talking here with a Samaritan woman, and she says, "Well, our fathers worshipped on this mountain. It's Mount Gerizim. If you're sitting at Jacob's well, you can look up and see it." So when she says this mountain, she's, you know, looking at it, pointing at it. And the Jews say we ought to worship down in Jerusalem. And Jesus says, "The hour's coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father." And then he says this really strange thing in verse 22. "You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know. For salvation is of the Jews." Now, what is that? Is that just a little bit of, you know, in-group chauvinism on Jesus' part, or is there something further behind it? Turns out there is. So get the setting. Here in the first century AD, the Samaritans are still saying, "Well, we say we ought to worship in our temple," and Jesus says, "You don't even know what you worship." There's a backstory for that, and in Josephus, Antiquities, Book 12, we find out what it is. Way back in the second century B.C., Antiochus Epiphanes went on a rampage and actually sacked Jerusalem and slaughtered a pig on the altar, profaning the altar in the temple in Jerusalem.
Now, who was he?
He was a Greek ruler who had a gripe with the Jews, and boy, did he pick it. Well, it turns out the Samaritans realized that he was serious about doing damage to the Jews, so they wrote him a letter, which we have at least a sort of summary of in Josephus. And here's what their letter says. "To Antiochus the God," because he called himself the incarnation of Zeus. And then it goes on to say, basically, you know, "We're not Jews. We don't worship in Jerusalem. We have our own temple. And to show you that we want nothing to do with the Jews, we would like to dedicate our temple to the god Jupiter. Is that okay with you?" And he says, "Sure, do it." Now go back to the scene with Jesus and the woman at the well, and Jesus says to her, "You don't even know what you worship." Do you see how that pops out in three dimensions now?
Right.
You guys have so little interest in the worship of God, you're even willing to rededicate your temple to a heathen god just to buy off somebody who's coming around, you know, on a military rampage. That's a telling blow. That hurts.
And that was done about 200 years prior. So there's 200 years of history prior to this comment by Jesus. Am I,
yeah.
am I reading
yeah,
this correctly?
Yeah, that's almost exactly 200 years before,
right.
somewhere in probably the 170s to 160s BC. Yeah.
Right. That is amazing, that insight right there. So Jesus isn't even supposed to be talking to this woman.
Not according to the way that Jews and Samaritans usually worked. And there's more. I mean, when his disciples come back, right? What do they say? Yep. John tells us in verse 27 that just then his disciples came back, they marveled that he was talking with a woman at all.
Right. Hey, wait a minute. We got to marinate on something here, because this brings this passage that we quote all the time as apologists even into a brighter focus right
yeah.
now, and that is John 4:24, when he says God is spirit. Why does he say that right there, Tim?
Because
Jupiter wasn't spirit, was he?
No, and you know, the idea that God is spirit. I mean, Jesus is constantly telling people that what they think they have to go down to the temple to get, they can get from him directly.
Right.
Right. Forgiveness of sins.
Right.
You know, yeah, you can get that right here. You don't need to go anywhere for that now. That's God is seeking people who will worship him in spirit and in truth. Here's Jesus in Samaria talking to a woman who's living with some guy who's not even her husband. But he's talking to her seriously and says, God is seeking people who will worship him in spirit and in truth.
Mm.
Man, he knows where the people are who, sinners though we all be, will turn to him, will hear his voice.
So all these insights that you've gotten just from, say, this passage, you got from reading Josephus and putting two and two together.
Yeah, and reading other people who had read Josephus and had already put it together. So I wish I could claim that I got all these insights on my own, but actually there are a lot of smart people who've done a lot of this before, and reading some of their books is a good idea also.
I know some of our listeners are going, well, what are those books, Tim?
Yeah, I would recommend...
What are they?
There's a New Zealand classicist named E.M. Blakelock, B-L-A-I-K-L-O-C-K, and he wrote a couple of books, The Century of the New Testament, The Compact... Handbook of New Testament Life. He's got wonderful insights. He's a sort of historian by inclination, classicist by training, and he really makes it come alive. There are also some books by, I think, is it Paul Barnett?
Right.
A couple of books, Behind the Scenes of the New Testament. So he's got some good stuff like that. I would recommend that you look for those. If you want some older books that are available free, I will give you some that you can post on your website, links mm-hmm. to, and people can download them for free.
Well, you have them on Historical Apologetics, don't you?
I have some of these on that site, and we're expanding it all the time. But I got to tell you, I've got stuff that you can't find anywhere else, stuff that I've scanned myself, because neither Google nor Microsoft has gotten around to it. So we've got lots of stuff, yeah.
Well, what are the PDFs you currently have on Historical Apologetics that relate to this background information of the New Testament?
One of the best ones would be Nathaniel Lardner's Credibility of the Gospel History. In his collected works, it fills 4.5 volumes. And that's 4.5, 650-page, large-page, small-print volumes. So if you want to read all about Rome and Christianity, just dive right in Volume 1 after the biography of Lardner. Just get right into the history, and he's got a terrific amount of stuff, all free. And you can keep going there for quite a long time.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. Absolutely. Now, the Samaritans were one group of people. Also, depicting the Jews is another.
Yeah,
and we've only got about a minute before the break, so we'll pick it up after the break. But tell us a little bit about how they depict the Jews.
Well, just notice the intimacy of familiarity with detail. Like, there's these repeated references to, quote-unquote, the prophet in John 1:21, John 6:14, John 7:40, and they're never explained. So you have to know enough about Judaism to go back to Deuteronomy 18:15 and see this promise of a prophet like unto Moses, and then connect the dots and see that they're still looking for this guy today. Mm. The low popular estimate of women, right? The disciples marvel Jesus is talking to women. There were Pharisees who went around with their eyes closed in public so they wouldn't even look at a woman. There are Jewish teachings that you're not supposed to speak to a woman, not even your wife, out in the street or in public. There's a Jewish teaching that it's better to burn the books of the law than to teach them to a woman. And here's Jesus freely conversing with a woman who's a Samaritan woman of notorious character. And for Jesus, he just blows past all of these kinds of prohibitions and social taboos, and he knows what he's doing.
And he wants us to do the same thing. We ought to be hanging out with the people who we wouldn't consider to be, or the moralists wouldn't consider to be people we ought to hang out with. We ought to go to those people and tell them about the free gift of salvation. That's
right.
What Jesus did, and that's what we're supposed to do as well. We're talking to Dr. Tim McGrew from Western Michigan University. Fascinating conversation. And we're talking about the tapestry of the New Testament and how there's so much evidence that these individuals were eyewitnesses because they know what's going on in first century Palestine. And we're going to talk a little bit about Pilate when we get back. Pilate, a real figure in history. We know a lot about him even outside the New Testament. So don't go away. Back in 2 minutes. I'm Frank Turek. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. The tapestry of the New Testament documents and how they perfectly overlay first century Palestine, the history we know about first century Palestine, the New Testament writers obviously know about. They are making references to historical facts that can be checked out, and they get them right. We're talking to Dr. Tim McGrew from Western Michigan University. Tim, let's talk about three characters very quickly, if we could.
Sure.
Let's start with James, the half-brother of Jesus. Then maybe we can move on to John the Baptist and Pilate. These are all individuals mentioned by Josephus. What does he say about those individuals?
Right. Okay. So for James, Jesus' half-brother, he mentions him in the Antiquities of the Jews, Book 20. And he just says, it's very brief. He tells how he was killed in Jerusalem, and how some of the more pious Jews were shocked by this. The details of James' death are, of course, not told us in the New Testament, but we find that from Josephus, it's kind of curious, he refers to him and identifies him by his connection with Jesus, who is called the Christ. That would be the Messiah. So he identifies him in a way that he expects his readers to recognize. Well, he's only mentioned Jesus, who was called the Christ, one previous time, and that's back two books earlier in Book 18 of the Antiquities, Chapter 3. So probably that's evidence for the authenticity of the famous and sometimes disputed passage where he talks about Jesus himself. But that identifying mark, he was known as the brother, half-brother, of Jesus, who was called the Christ. That was his known designation. So that does sort of speak to a certain amount of notoriety.
Now, according to Josephus, why is James killed?
James is killed because he won't speak out against those who are deviating from strict Jewish law. He's been keeping the sacrifices. He's been living in Jerusalem, doing the things that a devout Jew would continue to do. But of course, he's a Christian. And when he won't denounce these innovations, as the story goes, they hurl him down from a high parapet of, high tower, and he falls. And there's a little bit of disagreement between the exact details that Josephus gives him what we learned from later church history about how he was ultimately killed. But apparently, that much that he was put up in a high tower, asked to denounce the Christians, wouldn't do it, got pushed out, and fell and was killed that way. So he died refusing to speak out against Christianity. And, of course, the Christians knew what to make of that. They knew his character. They knew who he was.
And this is approximately 62 A.D.
Occurs. And it's not long thereafter, of course, that everything comes to a head in Jerusalem. It's about four more years, and they're under the Roman heel.
Right. So he in a sense, dies as a martyr, according to Josephus, who probably was in Jerusalem at the time because he became one of the rebels in 66 A.D., correct?
Yep. Yeah, although he never liked the sort of more zealot aspect of it. He blamed them for having really sort of fomented a war they couldn't win. But he was on the Jewish side, yeah, and so he was no doubt there and no doubt knew about this one directly.
And so he mentions him as the brother of the Christ.
Of Jesus, who was called the Christ, right? There are a lot of different characters named Yeshua. It's just a version of Joshua.
Right.
That's a very common name in Palestine, but he identifies as him as the brother of the Jesus who was called the Christ. So that's the
now, if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm going this by memory, I haven't read this in a while, but didn't the Jews use some kind of transitionary or a period of transition in the power to get James killed? Am I thinking properly?
I think Albinus was coming in as governor or going out, but in any event, it was a period when the governor wasn't actually there, and they used that opportunity. And then people who were upset with what they had done told the governor, and the governor came in, and some heads rolled as a result of their having used that transitional period. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, now tell us a little bit about John the Baptist. What does Josephus say about him?
Yeah, well, John the Baptist was a pretty popular preacher, and Josephus mentions him, says he was a righteous man. Many people thought that the bad things that happened to Herod Antipas happened because he had had John killed. And then he tells this sort of sordid backstory about how Herod Antipas was married, and then he fell in love with his half-brother's wife, and he persuaded her to divorce his half-brother, and he divorced his wife. And by the way, this sheds light on where Jesus' teaching on divorce comes in, right? I mean, you know, Mark 10:12, where Jesus says, "And if a woman divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery." He's talking about the ruling couple. He's talking about the people who were in charge in the very place where he is there preaching. But it's interesting, Josephus, who's not real close to that particular thing, just says Herod was afraid that maybe there would be an uprising centered on John the Baptist. He was very popular. Matthew chapter 14 tells us with more detail about the circumstances of his death, and that it was really Herodias, his new wife, who was angry at John because he kept on saying that it wasn't lawful for them to be married. She requested it. And the funny thing about that is that we know from Luke 8:3 that the Christians had good sources of information. They had sources inside of Herod's household. Herod's household manager was the husband of one of the women who ministered to Jesus and his followers. So this is a case where Josephus makes an educated guess, not a bad guess, but the Christians actually have better information about what's going on, and so we can actually see a good historical reason to take more seriously what they say about Herod's motives than what Josephus says.
And don't we learn who the daughter of the stepdaughter of Herod was from Josephus?
Yeah, Herodias' daughter Salome. So we get her name there, and we find out a little bit more about her and the whole sort of sorry, nasty situation. See, Herodias had been a Jewess, and so it was against the laws of her own country for her to divorce her first husband. So no doubt she just got a Roman divorce, and it's kind of a soap opera thing. The Herod family is like that.
So among the New Testament characters mentioned by Josephus, you've got Jesus, you've got James, his half-brother, who dies as a martyr in 62 AD in the very city Jesus is supposed to have risen from the dead in. Mm-hmm. You've got John the Baptist mentioned, and you also have Pilate. What does he say about Pilate?
This is really interesting. We get a lot of information from Josephus and from another Jewish writer of the first century, Philo of Alexandria, about Pilate. We learn he became governor just before the beginning of John the Baptist's ministry, so he had not been there a long time, and he lasts about 10 years. From Josephus, you find out that Pilate did not get along with the Jews. He was a proud man, he was a stubborn man, he resented the obstinacy of the Jews, and he was constantly provoking them. So, for example, Josephus, Antiquities 18, Chapter 3, just before the section that talks about Jesus, you learn about how Pilate brought the Roman insignia with Caesar's image into the city of Jerusalem by night. And the Jews felt that this was, in effect, a slap in the face to their second commandment about no graven images. And so he had sent these into Jerusalem, but he was over in Caesarea, so they came out to Caesarea where he was to protest. And this ended up in a six-day standoff where finally he said, "I'm just going to kill you." And they threw themselves on the ground and said, "It's okay, kill us. We're prepared to die rather than to stop our protests." And at this point, Pilate, stubborn though he is, realizes that if he has them killed for that, it won't go down well in Rome when the news gets there. And so he relents and he backs off. But he's not happy about it. Philo, this other Jewish author, Alexandria, slightly older contemporary of Jesus, talks about another situation. Pilate had some votive shields set up in the palace of Herod in Jerusalem. They didn't have images on them, but they had some inscriptions. And so he's got these shields set up there in private quarters where nobody has to look at them, but some of the Jews hear about it. And, oh, they get angry, and they tell him that they want him to take them out. And he says, no, I'm not going to do it. So they write, and this is an important point, they write to the emperor Tiberius. Mm-hmm. And Tiberius is ticked off. And he writes a letter back to Pilate saying, you take those blankety-blank shields down off the wall. What are you doing provoking these people? Mm-hmm. He's just reproaching him and reviling him in the most bitter manner, says Philo, for his having done this. He also grabbed the temple treasury money and used it to build an aqueduct, and the Jews were furious about this. On that occasion, Pilate had his soldiers kill some of the Jews. That may be the famous occasion that got the sort of riotous reaction was put down so violently. It may be what was remembered in Luke 13:1, where it says Pilate mingled some of the blood of the Galileans with their sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to say for sure, not enough detail, but that may be the occasion. But now, take all of this, put it in context, come up to the trial before Pilate, and what do the Jews say? It's a very, very shrewd thing that they say to him.
Yeah, they say, you're no friend to Caesar if you let this guy go, right?
Right. You are no friend of Caesar's. And that's just the canniest charge they could have made.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the John 18:12. You know, they're challenging him with making himself a king. That's a imperial offense. And saying he's not Caesar's friend. Well, he's already had one run-in with the Jews where Caesar got pissed off with him, so this would make sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's one little other detail. I'll just close with this thing about Pilate. You notice in Matthew, Pilate's wife is with him because
mm-hmm.
she sends him this message saying, oh, don't have anything to do with this man. Now, here's a really funny thing. The Emperor Augustus had said, if you're going to be a governor in the provinces, you cannot take your wife with you. So it would seem like the gospel authors have made a mistake. Maybe Matthew's just wrong. But it turns out that after his death, that was widely disregarded. And in fact, in the Roman Senate, 7 years after Augustus' death, somebody raised a proposal, hey, let's start enforcing that prohibition, and he gets voted down. So actually, Pilate's having his wife with him is exactly what was done, even though formally speaking, it was a violation of a rule.
It was a rule they weren't enforcing.
Rules they weren't enforcing. Now, mm-hmm. who knows about rules that were on the books but weren't being enforced? You know, you'd really have to know an awful lot about the ins and outs of it, or just live there and really be there and be an honest reporter of what you know.
Amazing insights, Dr. Tim McGrew from Western Michigan University, historicalapologetics.org. Check it out. Tim, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me, Frank.
Hey, we're going to have Dr. Tim back again because just great stuff. I'm Frank Turek. Crossexamine.org is our website. See you next time. God bless.